Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Just the headlines from Annie Murphy-Paul's new book, get your attention real quick. Practically everything a pregnant woman does, eats, breathes, experiences in her 9 months carrying may carve her child for life. Every facet. Is this a recipe for super kids, for crazed moms? We'll ask this hour on Point. Could 9 months in the womb really shape us for life? You can join the conversation. What do you think? Does the perfect pregnant mom create the perfect baby and vice versa? Is that brilliant insight or too much to bear? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now is science journalist Annie Murphy-Paul. Her new book is getting a lot of attention. We realized we weren't finished thinking about it, talking about it. It is Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shape the Rest of Our Lives. Annie Murphy-Paul, welcome. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
So there you are all over the place. Cover of Time magazine. We've got the pregnant mama and your book, this thesis. It's not brand new, but you're bringing it all together and bringing it very front and center. Remind us of the sort of basic points of what you're laying out here. And we want to ask you about the response you've had to making this so front and center. But take us back to the basics of what you're telling here.
Sure. So Origins explores the emerging science of fetal origins, and that's the idea that the conditions we experience in the womb during the 9 months of gestation have a long-lasting influence. And when I say long-lasting, I mean not just into infancy and childhood, but even into middle age and old age. So it's kind of a mind-bending idea when you think about it. On one level, we all know that what a pregnant woman eats and drinks, you know, we're all careful about those things these days. So we know on some level that these things matter. I think what's new about what I've presented in Origins is this notion that actually that impact can be larger than we knew, and that it can be much more long-lasting than we knew.
Take us to some of the primary, points of interuterine experience and then life experience.
Sure. Well, one of the most striking examples, and the one that kind of got the field started off in 20 or so years ago, was pioneered by a British doctor named David Barker, who noticed that the people who lived in the poorest areas of Wales and England had the highest rates of heart disease in middle age. And this was surprising to him because we think of heart disease as being a product of sedentary lifestyles and rich food, kind of a disease of affluence. Mm-hmm. So he looked a bit deeper and found that there was a very strong connection between low birth weight. So 5.5 pounds or less at weighing that at or less at birth, which is often a sign of poor prenatal nutrition, and then heart disease 40, 50, 60 years later. And he came up with a theory that was for a long time known as the Barker hypothesis, which was that faced with insufficient nutrition in the womb, the fetus diverts most of its nutrients to the organ that is most critical for its survival, the brain, thereby cheating the heart and other organs, which allows, and this act of triage allows the fetus to survive, to be born, and then even perhaps to grow into old age. But it does carry a cost that becomes apparent many years later in higher rates of heart disease. So when Barker proposed this theory, he was literally laughed at, ridiculed, derided, because the belief that heart disease was the product of genes and adult lifestyle choices, you know, whether you exercise, whether you eat in a healthy way, those beliefs were so strong that he was dismissed out of hand. But then over the last 20 years, his research has been replicated over and over again, and people in the medical establishment have begun to recognize the fact that prenatal influence is not the only thing that shapes us by any means as children and adults, but it's another factor that we haven't before until now paid enough attention to.
And the horizon of areas in which people are looking at this has just exploded. I mean, take us to some more of the most persuasive, you know, if X in the womb, then Y in life connections that are emerging, Emmy.
Yes, and if you look in the medical literature now, it's stunning. You'll see references to the prenatal origins of cancer, obesity, diabetes, mental illness, just almost any condition you can think of, even conditions associated with old age like osteoporosis and cognitive decline or senility. You'll see the prenatal origins of those things, the study of that. So it is kind of stunning how many areas are being touched by this approach. I guess some of the more surprising findings to me were I often write about psychology and psychiatry and mental illness, so I was particularly interested in findings that suggested that pregnant women who experience severe stress, and I'm not talking about everyday ordinary stress, but severe stress like women who are in a war zone might experience or a natural disaster, their offspring have a higher risk of developing schizophrenia in later life.
You point to a study of women who were pregnant during the Six-Day War in Israel, 1967.
Yes, and those offspring who were gestated in the women who experienced that war in the second month of their pregnancy gave birth to children who eventually had a higher risk of schizophrenia, developing schizophrenia as young adults. So it was very specific. You'll often find these effects in fetal origins, the science of fetal origins, that it corresponds to a particular trimester or even a particular month when certain organs are being formed or certain, you know, brain circuits are being wired. And if you look at something like thalidomide, which I look at in my chapter on the effects of drugs, the exposure to drugs and pollutants and other toxins, it mattered on which day the pregnant woman took a thalidomide pill. That would correspond with a certain type of birth defect.
In other words, at what precise point in its fetal development?
In its gestation, yes. So there's a lot that we still have to learn, but it's some of these effects are just stunning to think about.
What's the obesity link that people are finding?
Yes, well, the thought is we all are aware of the obesity epidemic that, you know, is prevalent in America today. And the thinking is that and children are becoming obese earlier and earlier. The thinking is that some of this predisposition to obesity may begin in the womb with women who are seriously overweight or obese when they become pregnant, or who gain excessive amounts of weight during their pregnancy, that this is, in effect, programming the fetus's appetite and metabolism, and perhaps even its preferences, its food preferences in the womb, so that that child has a higher chance of becoming obese, him or herself, later on. And so it's not just genes shared between mother and child, of course, and it's not just family eating habits that are shared between mother and child, but actually the 9 months of that first environment that the child is exposed to.
And cancer, what in that 9 months could end up raising vulnerability to cancer years later? What?
Well, there's a couple different answers to that. One that I talk about, again, in that chapter of origins about exposure to chemicals and toxins. There was a very interesting experiment done by a scientist at Columbia named Frederica Pereira. She had pregnant women, more than 500 pregnant women, wear a backpack everywhere they went for 2 days. They put it next to their beds when they went to sleep. And that backpack had a air monitor in it, and it was measuring the levels of a particular pollutant in the air known as polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. Mm. And then she was able to sample the umbilical cord blood of the babies once they were born. And those who had higher levels of PAHs and those whose mothers had been exposed to higher levels of PAHs during pregnancy had subtle changes to their DNA that are associated with the development of cancer later on. So that's the beginning of a science of how exposure to environmental toxins may increase our risk of cancer. There's also been work on the effects of overnourishment in the womb, what we're talking about with obese women being pregnant, and the development of breast cancer later on in life in the offspring. But on the upside, I mean, I do want to emphasize that this book is not all gloom and doom or all bad news. This is the science of fetal origins is making pregnancy into a frontier, a scientific frontier in which there are all these opportunities to not only understand better, but to potentially head off some of these conditions. So that there's a scientist in Oregon, David Williams, who's working on providing fetuses, and right now this is animal research, with chemo protection from cancer that should last for their entire lives, that's granted by exposing them to certain beneficial chemicals during pregnancy by giving a certain compound that's derived from cruciferous vegetables, so like broccoli and cabbage and Brussels sprouts, to the pregnant mother animals. These are mice that he's working with. Their offspring are resistant to cancer for their entire lives, even though they only encountered this chemical during gestation and during lactation when they were nursing with their mother. So I think there's hope here for understanding the origins of a lot of common conditions and diseases, and hope for preventing them.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about shaping babies, shaping lives, the apparently lifelong effects of our lives in the womb. Annie Murphy-Paul is with us. She is a science journalist and author of the new book, Origins, How the 9 Months Before Birth Shape the Rest of Our Lives. And Annie, you were pregnant as you were looking at a lot of this. I mean, this can sound kind of overwhelming. If you're not the perfect vessel, you've scarred the child for life.
Well, that's certainly not the lesson that I came away from after my 9 month immersion in this field of fetal origins. What I came away with was something quite different, actually, which is the idea that actually there is no such thing as a perfect pregnancy, because each fetus is being shaped by the idiosyncratic mix of influences that are brought to bear on him by his mother and I shouldn't say he, but its mother and its mother's world. Because what we know now is that the fetus is not sealed away but in the placenta. It's not in a bubble unaffected by anything that goes on. It's actually it's engaged in this intimate relationship with the pregnant woman and with the world that she lives in. It's actually taking cues from her and from her environment, preparing itself for the specific world that it will be entering. So there really isn't such a thing as a perfect pregnancy so much as your pregnancy, which is preparing your baby for the life that you'll share with him. So that actually was a very reassuring idea to me, even to the extent of, you know, a 7-month-old fetus. Starting at 7 months, the fetus can begin tasting and smelling what the pregnant woman eats. So you're, in a sense, initiating your fetus, your child to be, into your culture. You know, what more powerful expression of culture is there than food? You're exposing your fetus to, you know, the spices and the flavors that you like even before your child is born. So,
and it's not just a matter of taste there. I mean, it goes right down to gender selection. You describe how you know, what you ate for breakfast was eventually shaped by what you learned about the impact on that little lima bean with the beating heart, as you describe it, in the womb.
Yes, there is an odd kind of literature that's grown up around the idea of fetal sex selection. We're all aware of that in terms of the kind of humankind selection where that goes on in countries like China, where female fetuses are aborted. But what I'm talking about is a natural process in which it's been found over and over again that following disasters and crises of various kinds, economic collapses and wars and things like that, fewer male babies are born. And some scientists believe there's an evolutionary advantage to having female offspring when times are tough. And so you might say, well, how you know, the gender of a fetus of a child is determined at the moment of conception, which is true, but such a small percentage of fertilized eggs actually make it to a live birth. We don't think of all the eggs that are, you know, washed away before a woman even knows that she's pregnant, or all the fetuses lost to miscarriage. So that there are influences from the environment, like stress and malnutrition, that can affect the sex ratio, how many boys and how many girls are born. And there was a study. It's you know, I think
you wanted a son the second time around, and you were eating a Raisin Bran every morning. Why?
I did want a son. Yeah, I did want a son. I would certainly be happy with whatever came my way. And I did have a son. But yes, there was one study that came out suggesting that women who ate cereal for breakfast were more likely to have boys. And the idea was that women who had a substantial carbohydrate hearty breakfast were giving a signal to their bodies that they lived in a world of plenty and abundance. This is a world in which you could take the slightly higher risk of having a male child, and that male child would prosper and do well. So I didn't change. I eat Raisin Bran anyway. I should say, okay. I wasn't actually trying to manipulate my fetus's sex by what I ate for breakfast, but I do explore that very intriguing literature on fetal sex.
Annie Murphy Paul is with us. Her new book is Origins: How the 9 Months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives. We're going to get another view from Dallas, Texas in just a moment. A call or two first. Lisa in Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for this book. It's really wonderful, and wonderful to see it on the cover of Time magazine. So congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
I just wanted to address the issue of feeling overwhelmed as a mother, and we're already so up there with pressures as parents, whether we're first-time parents or we're coming into this as you were with your second pregnancy. And I wanted to say that there, but you were correct when you first said that this information hasn't, you know, it's not new. It's been around for a while. And there are a lot of organizations, institutes, grassroots movements with parents who are looking at the issue not from a, you know, from the overwhelming standpoint of now I have to ship this one thing or that one thing, or it's a big long list. What we are looking at it now to make it bearable and to make sense of it is that it is a part of what's happening that is called the paradigm shift. I don't know if you've heard that the paradigm shift from this industrial worldview where Americans especially look at their children and the process of raising children as a product we're developing. And it comes right out of industrial ideals instead of a more integrated, holistic view, which says, you know, you're right, it's not one thing, it is everything. And then we can settle in with that and be calm and forgiving of ourselves and do the best we can, knowing that we're going to have to make what we call conscious choices.
It's not just putting in ingredients according to some industrial formula and outcomes, a product at the other end. Lisa, let us hold that thought for a minute, if you would. And Annie, joining us also right now from Dallas, Texas, is Dr. Ann Donewald, clinical psychologist, author specializing in issues around pregnancy. She's author of Even June Cleaver Would Forget the Juice Box, Cut Yourself Some Slack and Still Raise Great Kids in the Age of Extreme Parenting. The tagline on her website, just to give you the flavor, is Arming Women Against the Pressures of Modern Motherhood. And Dr. Donewald, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here's Annie Murphy Paul. She's pulling together all this research, and it is quite fascinating. At the same time, you know, it must make women who are pregnant or contemplating pregnancy think, oh my gosh, how can I be good enough?
Absolutely. In fact, I had the experience last week of a woman sitting in my office waiting to come in. She was sitting in the outer office waiting to come into my office, and she was reading the Time magazine and threw the magazine down on the couch and said, now I know everything that I did wrong during pregnancy, which I think just shows what anxious parents do with it. And we wish, Annie, that every expectant mother or mother who was woman who was planning to be pregnant had that thought in their head as you did, that there is no such thing as a perfect pregnancy and that it is an idiosyncratic mix. Because I think that this is what women sort of get stuck on, is the small details, thinking they can control it all, when really that's the basic conundrum of parenting. You can't control it all.
Well, and yet that the woman is, is the vessel in some sense. And, Annie's saying, well, there's things during those 9 months that may shape chances of obesity, mental illness, cancer. How can a woman look at that, Anne, and not think, I had better really get on top of my, life during this period?
Well, that is exactly what they do in their heads. And I guess that's what I try and do, is bring that kind of perspective and that kind of rational thinking, that, again, we have to control what we can and let go of the rest. We have to make those conscious choices, like Lisa was just mentioning.
Mm-hmm. Annie, people have to make a living. They have to live in the world that they live in. They've got to... they've got to eat to nourish that baby, and they may or may not have access to ideal nourishment. I mean, is the path that is kind of suggested by this science, is it a doable path? Is it an impossible path, Annie?
Oh, I think it's very doable. I mean, just to take one example that a lot of pregnant women are concerned about, stress during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. In my book, I do report the findings that traumatic stress, life-threatening stress like that experienced by people in a war zone, I think maybe we mentioned this earlier, that can lead to low birth weight, to premature delivery, in some cases to birth defects, to a higher risk of those things. But moderate everyday stress, the kind of stress that a working woman might experience, or a woman who's caring for other children that she's had, that actually seems to have a beneficial effect on the fetus. That seems to accelerate brain development in such a way that you can measure faster neural conduction rates in infants who've experienced moderate prenatal stress, and they score higher on tests of cognitive ability when they're 2 years old. So I think there's some good news here in terms of it's not all don't do this, don't do that. And in fact, I very deliberately set out in this book to counter those messages that pregnant women get in bits and pieces, to put it into a bigger scientific context of this burgeoning field that is presenting hope and opportunities, as well as, some cautions to women, and to put it in cultural and historical context that the scientific findings, as we were saying, are not always brand new, but the idea itself of that we are shaped by experiences and events before birth is actually ancient. It's something that humans have believed for millennia, and it's something that we kind of forgot just for a few decades there in the 20th century, when we thought that the fetus was completely impervious to outside influence. Now we know that's not true.
But you heard the reaction there of the patient in Dr. Dunnewald's, waiting room, reading the Time mm-hmm. magazine story with mm-hmm. a lovely pregnant woman, and how the first 9 months shaped the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And, she feels like she's blown it. I mean, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, listen, this is how I think about it. And as I said, I was pregnant when I was researching and reporting this. So I've sympathized with every woman who feels burdened by anxiety during pregnancy. I certainly had all those feelings as well. And I used the book to work through them. Mm-hmm. And the view that I came to have was that, look, these findings are real. It doesn't help anyone to dismiss them out of hand or to see them as some kind of patriarchal conspiracy mm-hmm. to, keep women down. And it also doesn't help anyone to let them make you crazy with worry and with anxiety. So is there a more productive, proactive, positive way that we can approach these findings, which we're only going to be hearing more about? I really strongly believe, from what I've seen, that this field is only going to grow is only going to become more important in coming years. So we need to find a way to deal with these findings, and my book was an attempt to help women do that.
It's going to set up a whole chain of questions. We've got a lot of those here with us today. Annie Murphy-Paul's book is Origins. Dr. Anne Dunnewald joins us from Dallas, and she's looking at the pressures of modern motherhood and how to deal. Margaret in Manchester, New Hampshire. Margaret, you're on the air. What's your thought, Margaret?
Hello, and thank you. I just have a quick question. When I was pregnant with my 3-month-year-old, I read an article that said morning sickness was in relation to their IQ, and that mothers that had morning sickness had smarter babies, and I was horrified because I didn't really have morning sickness, so I'm wondering if my child is average, below average, above average.
There's the cause and effect question comes right away. I don't know. Is there a connection that you know of, Annie, between morning sickness and IQ testing later?
Yeah. I did see that study. It didn't seem like a particularly strong study to me. And I would, you know, remind everyone who reads studies that we're never talking about a specific case here. We're talking about, an increased or decreased risk of something or other. So, in your particular case, I wouldn't worry for one second that the fact that you didn't have morning sickness means that your child is not as intelligent. I would just thank goodness that you didn't have to go through that awful nauseous feeling when you were pregnant.
And Dunawal, do you see women coming in with a kind of, womb determinism, thinking, well, whatever I've done, it's done now. My child's life is shaped and I can't go back.
Well, I think that women do have a sense about how the newborn brain is very plastic and can change even past the in utero. That's one thing that helps women sort of ride with this kind of information and make sense of it, is that we do know that there are multiple influences. And I think it's just the anxiety gets away with us when we focus in on one particular one, like this study that Margaret is talking about. Because certainly, perhaps in that study that was shown, I don't know that study, but that certainly morning sickness is not the be-all and end-all, the only factor that affects IQ. But that's what we have to do with it in terms of perspective, is back up and say, okay, that's one thing, but as you said, I think, in the first part, Annie, is that it's a multitude of factors that influence us, even in utero.
Margaret takes solace right there. Verl in Salt Lake City, Utah. Verl, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I had two questions that I'd like to ask if I can.
Sure.
The first is, I was born with all the allergies, asthma, eczema, the whole works, sinus, hay fever. And I was wondering if there's anything that can be done to bypass that possibly, and also the criminal element. What are the causes, and how can we keep that from happening to our babies possibly?
Verl, let us pick them up. Annie, our time is short before the break, but allergies determined in the womb, future allergies, and what about future behavior, maybe even criminal behavior? Is that off the chart, off the map, or not?
Yeah. Well, the allergies research I'm aware of has examined whether eating peanuts and other nuts during pregnancy can either predispose or protect the offspring from allergies. And the evidence here, as in many areas of fetal origin science, is conflicting and confusing, and it's still very much being worked out. But there does seem to be some evidence that what's known as a Mediterranean diet full of whole grains, fruits, vegetables, that can head off allergies in some people who are predisposed to it. And it's a healthy diet in any case. So as to the
behaviors,
the criminal, I that's going much farther than any fetal origin scientist that I know of. Certainly there's some early efforts to look at temperament and how that might be shaped in the womb, how depression or anxiety might be transmitted by in utero conditions, but criminality, I think, is still off in the future.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about shaping babies, shaping lives, and the apparently lifelong effects of our lives in the womb. Annie Murphy-Paul has pulled together a lot of the research and her own perspectives looking at this while pregnant in her new book, Origins. She joins us from New Haven, Connecticut today. Also with us, Dr. Ann Dunawald joins us from Dallas. She's a clinical psychologist, specializes in issues around pregnancy. Her book is Even June Cleaver Would Forget the Juice Box, Cut Yourself Some Slack, and Still Raise Great Kids in the Age of Extreme parenting. Annie, do scientists have a sense then, with all that's being and has been learned about the importance of what goes on in the womb? We've heard about nature and nurture forever. This projects it back into yet another arena. You know, is there a sort of percentages of impact, nature versus nurture versus in utero experience? Where's the greatest weight of what shapes us emerge from?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it would be literally impossible to come up with such percentages just because we can't really talk about nature and nurture working independently, or the in utero and the intrauterine environment working independently of those two things. They all work together. And in fact, as we're learning, it's during gestation that nature and nurture may intertwine the most in the most inextricable way, because we're used to talking about environment as one's childhood environment that begins at birth, but actually now we know that the environment of the womb is really critical. So that's, in a sense, our first environment. And we also know that genes are not just about, you know, some collection of DNA that we inherit at conception, but that DNA continues to be tweaked and tuned through this process known as epigenetic modification, which is the way that genes, without changing DNA, the way that genes can be turned up or down or off or on by in response to environmental input. Mm-hmm, and that mm-hmm. this happens especially consequentially during the 9 months of pregnancy. So what you're seeing is that I think of it as kind of a new chapter in the nature-nurture debate, because we're learning how all these things work together, and we're directing a new focus at this particular period, the 9 months of gestation, where it all happens in a very crucial way.
Let's go to Cheryl calling from West Vermont. Hi, Cheryl. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am the single adoptive parent of two, and my son is 20, my daughter is 13.
Okay.
For the first time in 2008, we had the opportunity to meet my son's birth mother. She accepted our invitation to come to his high school graduation.
Yes.
And I was fascinated when we offered her some Ben and Jerry's ice cream, and she...
You're in Vermont, after all. Sorry, Cheryl.
She indicated that she would not, she's not fond of chocolate, and I was surprised because my son has never touched chocolate in his life. But the most stunning piece of information was she and my son were talking, and she indicated that she is a list maker, and my son chuckled, looked at me and said, "Mom, did you hear that?" And I guess I was just baffled, and I asked my son later, privately, after she had left, I said, "You took AP biology. How in the world could you inherit a trait from someone with whom you never, ever lived?" And his eyes thought for a moment, and he said, "Oh, I don't know, Mom. There's something about every single enzyme in the body has the ability to reproduce itself." But I've just been amazed that an individual could inherit a characteristic from someone he didn't live with other than in utero.
And well, Cheryl, I mean, as you listen today, are you thinking inheritance in genetics, or are you thinking if his birth mother made lists and ate no chocolate while she was pregnant, maybe he got that somehow?
Absolutely.
What do you hear in these two stories? I mean, how much does what a mother eats shape the adult tastes of her offspring? And what about list making? I don't know. We heard about listening to Mozart. I don't know about making lists.
Yes, I think we have to remember that the genes exert a powerful effect on a lot of our behaviors. I think that's pretty well established, and I'm not in any way challenging that. I am saying we need to add another layer of complexity in our understanding of ourselves and our relationships with our mothers, because there's also this 9 month period where genes and environment were interacting to help create who we are, and that's a period that we haven't paid sufficient attention to. So something like I mean, you never know, but the chocolate, perhaps that was affected by what the birth mother ate when she was pregnant. That might well be a genetic characteristic. And the list making, I mean, that's, again, something that you could see there being a predisposition to orderliness or conscientiousness that has a high sort of genetic loading. It's so fascinating to speculate about, and we'll always do it. I don't imagine that these questions will ever be settled. But it's impossible in any one case to say, well, this was the prenatal influence, this was the prenatal environment, and this was genes.
And Dr. Dunwald, do you see pregnant women sort of trying to compose themselves in the image of the child that they hope to give birth to, you know, in what they eat and their moods and their environments? Do you see women trying to kind of model the child to come?
Oh, absolutely. Doing that even before this information, this is, as we said before, just more detailed that mm-hmm. is helpful that way, is that I think everybody has sort of that myth in their head that they can shape the child that way. And often the first time we come up as human beings against that kind of as a myth of control in our lives overall is with pregnancy and a newborn. If you think you can control your life and put it all in the right order and do all the right things, and a child will turn out a certain way, and there's nothing like parenting to show us that we're wrong.
Except, then we're hearing today from Annie Murphy-Paul, there's a lot of provisos and a lot of, conditions, but I think the bottom line does come across to a lot of people as confirming, you call it a myth, but confirming that what happens during those 9 months is shaping a lot of what emerges, Dr. Dunwald.
Oh, yes, it does shape it. There's no question. But is it the be-all and end-all? Is it the only answer? That's the part that I think feeds the anxiety for a lot of parents, is the all-or-nothing thinking that we think about, that we put on top of this, that it's either one extreme or the other, rather than being able to look rather rationally at the information across the board and say, yes, here are things that I can do and that do matter, but there are other ways to impact these things down the road, too.
Annie, here's a web comment from MJ. Says, what about the state of mind? Have there been studies on links between state of mind of the mother and general personality of the child? There we come to perhaps to the temperament question. What did you learn, Annie?
Yes. There's some budding research in this area that I write about in Origins. I went into the lab of Dr. Catherine Monk, who is a psychiatrist at Columbia University, and she brings pregnant women into her lab and measures their responses to stress and their fetus's responses to stress. And she brings in groups of women who are depressed and women who are not depressed pregnant women who are depressed but receiving treatment. So she's comparing their responses and their fetus's responses. And what she's found is that all the women, the pregnant women, respond to a stressful task with elevated heart rate and blood pressure, but only the fetuses of depressed or anxious women have their own jumps, their own spikes in those measures. So she's seeing that even in the womb, these fetuses of pregnant and or anxious women are reacting differently. They're more sensitive to stress even before birth. So then, of course, again, there's this question, is that just because the women are genetically predisposed to depression, anxiety, and so therefore their fetuses? That could well be, but it could also be that the intrauterine conditions provided by a depressed or anxious woman, higher levels of stress hormones, different kind of bodily, a different bodily state, is shaping that fetus over the course of 9 months of gestation and has something to do with how patterns of mental illness are often passed down in families. We think of that as being the products of shared genes or perhaps of parenting practices, but there may be a third way, which is which is intrauterine conditions.
But isn't this, I mean, a lot of this seems just beyond a mother's control. You're right, and it's funny or interesting about the Mona Lisa and speculation now based on some old records that the woman who sat for the famous painting by Da Vinci was 4 months pregnant at the time of that, and that sort of what the face of beatific inner mm-hmm. satisfaction may have been a result of her mm-hmm. pregnancy, but not all women respond to pregnancy with beatific inner satisfaction.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And that was part of the point when I described the Mona Lisa. I was describing that as one pole of what the sort of emotional options available to pregnant women. The other pole being, you know, the raging hormones, crying at the drop of a hat, you know, almost crazy with their pregnancy state. And I wanted to argue, I do argue in the book that these two poles are not the only shouldn't be the only emotional roles available to pregnant women. That pregnancy is a dynamic and a creative and a productive time. It's also a very disorderly and unruly time emotionally. And there's a lot going on, not only physically but emotionally and intellectually. And we need to respect the 9 months of pregnancy as this very important time, and not think of it as just sort of a 9 month wait for the big event, which is birth.
Oh boy, no kidding. No, we got a lot of feedback here online. You know, women unsettled by this. Shannon says, "Oh, good, another way to make moms feel guilty." Judy says, "I'm pregnant right now for the first time, and I'm scared out of my mind as it is. This is making me even more nervous." Mm-hmm. Dawn says, "This makes me nervous. I think women are already made to feel responsible for any bad behaviors that their children may exhibit, and now we are going to be responsible for heart disease and cancer in their later lives," kind of suggesting, you know, whoa, it's just too much. Joanna in Hamden, Connecticut. Joanna, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to call in. I just want to preface that I have not yet read the study.
And it's a lot of studies, and it's a very balanced treatment.
Studies, yes. Mm-hmm. But I am a pediatric oncologist, so certainly, you know, the prevention of cancer in utero would be something very close to my heart. But I do have a certain concern. You know, I've certainly given the news to parents many, many times about the diagnosis of cancer in a young child. Mm. And I often find it hard to convince them that, in fact, they did not cause this by something in utero.
Yeah.
Even though, in most cases, there's really never been an etiologic agent for most childhood cancers. So I'm concerned with the publication of this in the lay literature, mm-hmm. that it will be much harder to convince parents. And I hope this goes the way of folic acid and neural tube defects to really make prevention. But it does concern me because mothers and parents are both very guilty with that kind of diagnosis.
And you've got the very frontline, firsthand experience of that, Joanna. Annie Murphy-Paul, what do you say to that concern?
Well, I would say that it's certainly not something that was an afterthought when I was writing this book. It was front and center in terms of the issues that I deal with in the book, that at every stage I'm myself dealing with those anxieties and I'm trying to show the reader how we can work through them to arrive at a more balanced and I don't want to say rational, I because I think this is a deeply emotional topic. I just mean a state of understanding of this research that we can live with and maybe even gain hope or encouragement from, because I don't see it as a long list of do's and don'ts for pregnant women. I think that's often how it's presented, but I think the whole book is about the project of creating a new and better way of understanding this research, which the research is out there. We're going to have to deal with it. So I think we need to do the best we can in terms of being clear, being accurate, and also being smart enough to come up with an alternative framework that can produce an understanding, as I say, that we can live with, and that if we can think hard enough and think thoughtfully enough, mm-hmm. about these issues, we'll be able to arrive at an understanding that that doesn't drive us crazy.
Let's get one call from a guy here. Joe in Boston. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah
very interesting topic in being the proud father of a daughter, and I'd like to think that I had some role in this. So my question
congratulations.
Is really, what is the role or what is the influence that the father has during the gestation period? I know, you know, my generation, we like to talk to the you know, the belly and
right, right.
touch and do those things. Does it, any research or any impact been discovered there?
Joe, thanks. Annie, yeah, what's dad's role here in 9 months?
That's a great question. I mean, The dad's role is most important in terms of how he treats his pregnant partner, to be honest. If he supports her, if he, you know, helps alleviate her stress, if he can help support her materially, that helps. I mean, the woman's health and well-being is what is going to impact the fetus. And then in terms of, you know, speaking to the fetus, and there has been research that suggests that fetuses can hear voices and that they remember that they can remember them after birth. So I would encourage, of course, all those kinds of actions. You know, it is the woman's body that's gestating the fetus. And so it's what she eats, what chemicals she's exposed to, that, you know, those things are really more central than what the father does.
Support her. Anne Dunnewald, how do people take all this world of research on board and stay, you know, calm, cool, collected, and positive at the same time? What's the secret?
Well, I think that it means seeking out help that might be available. It's just tuning more into, if you have an awareness that my mood could be affecting my baby more, excuse me, taking steps to act upon it at that point. If there's stress at a marriage in relation to the father, if there's stress related to the work life, that you get to do extra things to take care of yourself and extra things to seek out help to deal with those sorts of things. So,
well, and let's have society rallied round to help women do that in pregnancy, especially as we begin to see all these connections. Absolutely fascinating. Dr. Anne Dunnewald in Dallas, Texas, clinical psychologist there. We're very happy to have had you with us today. And Annie Murphy Hall, author of Origins, thanks so much for your time and insights, Annie. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Good luck. This is On Point.